One of the things I try and resist doing is starting my sentences with "so." We, and it's really difficult. Really, how do I start without saying "so"? We have a full day of practice together to enjoy, to dive into, and just to name something which might already have happened or is very familiar for you at this kind of point in retreats, which is that the mind has its mind of its own, and it will start maybe talking about, you know, what are we going to do tomorrow, and what are we going to get up to the day after tomorrow, and how's it going to be to, you know, go back into the world. And one of those concepts that kind of creeps in is like, you know, when we go back to the real world from this imaginary world that we're in right now, which is kind of funny because in that moment we're actually imagining the real world out there, and we're actually experiencing the imagined world over here, which is kind of awkward for the mind when you point that out, but it's the way it feels at times. So we could take the idea there's no real world to go back to. Yeah, there's reality as we experience it here and now. This is real too, maybe more real, maybe not, but at least we can be honest about about how not so real it is. And that's something I want to continue, that we were touching on last night, want to continue with a little bit. By real here, we mean it's not independently happening. It's dependently happening. It's dependent on conditions. So we have this wonderful day ahead of us where we can actually play within these helpful conditions of retreat that have been set up by all of us, all of our dedication, all of our persistence, all of our patience, and many others, you know, those of us, those of our dear ones far from here who are supporting us to be here, and many beings who are here, you know, working hard to make it possible for us to be well nourished and to practice together. So, yeah, if you feel to, let's make the most of this. But also know we will talk more later about meeting the world, about meeting, changing, shaping the world that we live in. Yeah. But for now, let's get into the world that we're experiencing here, this world that you're in here, of these moments, these experiences. There's still some things that we can do here, some adjustments we can make here, and some of them are pretty radical. And actually need all the preceding days of practice to really open to be possible for. And the beautiful thing is what we do now will actually help us be the change we wish to see out there. And what we're doing now is a contribution to that as well. So we didn't get so clearly to a place of talking about equanimity yesterday. I was talking about it, but I didn't really signpost it as clearly as I might have. But hopefully we have a little bit of a feeling of wisdom, of the wisdom aspect. They're actually moving in the same direction. So the wisdom stuff is about equanimity. The equanimity stuff is rooted in wisdom. Wisdom is always liberating. That's what makes it wisdom. That's what makes it better than intelligence, cleverness, knowledge. It's there for wisdom. It's freeing. Wisdom is freeing. Yeah. So the opposite of wisdom, whatever you want to call that, I mean, let's just call it foolishness for a shorthand, right? So foolishness is common. Yeah. You find us and other beings being foolish quite common. Quite frequent. There's probably someone with a certain degree of power right now doing something foolish. You know, it's almost certain. And unfortunately, we'll all feel the harms of that. And there's also us in this moment. We're probably doing something foolish, probably mistaking something for something it's not, reacting to it in certain ways. So mistakes are going to happen, right? That's what it's like to be a fool. I make mistakes, you make mistakes, others make mistakes. What makes the wise different is that they're willing to learn from those mistakes. Willing to learn from those mistakes. Willing to investigate. Is this really the right thing? Is this really aligned with what I want to be doing? Is this really what's the limit of what's possible for me? And working to change their ways. Yeah. That's what makes them wise. Right? It's not extra knowledge necessarily, sometimes it is, but it's actually that dedication to stay with experience for longer, investigate it more, and work to change. To let go of mistaken views, to take up more skillful perspectives, to know that it's possible to create change, to create radical change. And radical change might seem, well, hang on, I mean, let's start with small change. And I think, yeah, actually, let's start with small changes. Let's start with gradual, subtle shifts. And that's how we actually get to radical change. So essentially, there is a more peaceful way to be in this moment. However you are in this moment, there is a more peaceful way to be. And whatever you're doing, whatever you're paying attention to, whatever you're experiencing, for sure, there's a more peaceful way to be. Yeah. And we can start to find our way towards that. Be more peaceful in this moment. And that's the path of equanimity. So there's a more peaceful, a more caring, a more kind, more considerate, a more wise way to be. No rush to get there, but just so you know, the wise have already set off. They're already on their way there, and we're going to go and join them, right? We're going to go and join up with the wise. And if we're quick, they might not notice that we didn't set off at the same time. Yeah. So we're going to join them in applied wisdom, knowledge, views. But also know, if what I'm about to suggest doesn't feel right for you, doesn't feel appropriate for you, then do what does feel appropriate, right? That's also wisdom. It's also wisdom. If that what feels appropriate, keep on going with practices that are already serving you, already helping you. Keep doing those. And even if we were going to be bringing in more of the wisdom stuff, we're going to really want the calmness, the steadiness, the gathered well-being, the metta, all of these things. That's still going to be the majority of our practice. Okay, so let's get weird for a little bit, and then we can make sense again. So the typical ways we make sense of the world, it makes sense that we would do it that way, but it's actually not optimal. It's not the most wise way of being, and it doesn't lead to the maximum amount of peace. So we want to bring a bit of questioning to that, a bit of doubt towards that. We tend to live with a sense that things are things. Yeah, that things have their own kind of existence. They have their own, what we call, substantiality. And that substantiality, it has substance to it, has solidity to it. There's something there to grab hold of. There's something there to push away. Yeah. We also project onto them a sense that, you know, they can bring me happiness or they can take happiness away. Okay? This is a typical way of seeing the world, right? If people didn't believe in that, capitalism would collapse within a moment, right? Well, I don't need that. There's no happiness in that. It's like, no, if you get this one, and of course you've already got one, but get the new one, then you'll be more happy, won't you? You say, yes. How much does it cost? Oh, more than you have. Oh, okay, well, I'll just work harder so that I can, you know. And we go along with this story. But the substantiality of things is one of the conditions of dukkha. When dukkha is there, what else is there? Objects become more solid, more substantial. Yeah, more graspable, more rejectable. Yeah, it's part of the experience in dukkha. When we change any of the conditions of dukkha, I'll come on to any of the conditions, but just briefly, like if we soften, right, if we bring in more kindness, allowance, yeah, we reduce the time pressure somewhere, if we take ourselves out of the center of the story, what happens to the substantiality of things? Have you noticed what happens? Is they lighten, become more ephemeral, yeah, pass through more easily. Right? So that substantiality, it didn't come from them. It comes from us. We give it to things. Does that make sense? We give things more and less substantiality. How much substantiality, having substance, do they bring from their side? Interesting. So this is the result, this is the process of equanimity. This is the result, this is the process of equanimity. Equanimity is the still point between pushing away and pulling towards. Equanimity, that non-reactivity, non-demanding. Not replacing it with anything else, just subtracting that reactivity. And what does it do to things? What does it do to selves? What does it do to time? Those things that seem like they had independent existence are revealed to not have that. Okay? So it's normal, it's habitual, it's common that we will see things exist, selves exist, time exists, and we just get to know it. Yeah. Do you know that song that was made famous by the film The Big Lebowski? I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in. So that's what we do. What's the conditions? The conditions that are conditioning dukkha. Yeah. We just go through them once more. On what does dukkha depend? What are the conditions? Yeah. Is there any obsessive demanding on experience happening right now? Yeah, any unreasonable demands for life to do it for me? Yeah. Is there any placing of myself in the center of this story? This is all about me. It's got to be my way or I'm going to be annoyed. Yeah. I've got to get this for me and then I'll be good enough if I get that. I'll be happy at last. Is there that tense contraction in the being, in the body, in the awareness, in the attention? There's tension in attention. Yeah. And all of this unnecessary. If you don't want it, stop it. Don't do it. It's a doing. Just stop doing it. That objectification, making things objects, adding substance to them that way. The time pressure. Has to be now. Should have already happened. That impatience. So the more and more we see this, hopefully the less and less we think that things have their own independent reality. And that's helpful. It's a little bit odd way of seeing experience, and it's sensible to also, you know, believe in things. Sensible too. Makes sense. But we're also trying something that doesn't make so much sense, but also feels more attuned to how we experience things. Things don't have substantiality. They don't contain happiness or unhappiness from their own side. We project that onto them, and we don't need to. It's optional, right? So things seeming like things from their own side is also called naive realism. Yeah, that kind of naive idea we have, like, oh, this is reality. At any moment, you think this is reality. Some Dharma teachings also kind of use this. You know, it's like we get to know things as they really are, you know, at times, right? It's kind of like this idea. I don't use that language myself. I think I understand what they're saying is that, you know, if you're really caught up in a lots and lots of thinking about things, really winding yourself up and you're getting into an irritation, agitation, things like a really big problem, we're really tight And then we're like, oh, wow, that storm passed. And now I see things clearly. Now I see things as they really are. And that's how it feels, because we've got a lot more clarity than we had just before. But we're interestingly still seeing things as things. You know, when we come out of that escalation of thinking or strong moods like agitation, anger, right, we're getting pulled along by anger, and then we come back and say, whoa, oh, that's past. And we feel like we see things clearly. But that's not the way things are. That's the way things appear in this kind of consciousness, this kind of way of things appearing. We can go further with this, that actually all of this here, all of the sounds, all of the sights, all of the tastes that you're experiencing of this so-called outer world are perceptions, right? Perceptions, appearances in your heart mind. All of this apparent externality here is a projection within your imagination of what the world could be. And then we believe that, yes, that's absolutely what it is. And then we act upon it. That's the normal, sensible way of living in the world. But in the Dharma, we can actually play a little bit more with that. Yeah. The Dhammapada, one of the kind of short little texts that was put together to kind of make the Buddha's teachings accessible, actually starts off with quite an incredible little poem. So we're going to use the word heart, but here we mean heart mind together, the kind of where the world appears in the heart mind. And so it says, phenomena, that's the appearances, phenomena are preceded by the heart. Heart comes first. Phenomena are preceded by the heart. They are ruled by the heart, ordered, structured, placed where they are by the heart. And they are made of the heart. Phenomena, appearances, they're made of the heart. Does that make sense? Does it not make sense? Not make sense. Appearances, okay? The appearance of things. First comes the condition of the heart, and appearances appear in the heart. You're in a bad mood, you're in a good mood, appearances appear differently, don't they? Yeah. And they are ruled by the heart. Right? Are you going to pay attention to this appearance or not pay attention to this appearance? If you don't pay attention to an appearance, where does it appear? Nowhere. It doesn't appear. And they are made of the heart. They are consciousness. Appearances are not made of anything else. They are made of the heart. Internal, intrapsychic appearances, but also birdsong. It's made of the heart. The experience of that is made of the heart. What a wonderful heart making birdsong. Yeah. And this is one of those areas where the Buddha's poetry and the translator's poetry is really amazing. Phenomena, from the Greek, appearances. Things are appearances. Yeah. The accuracy of that poem to show us, you know, we know a world of appearances, made of the heart, conditioned, conceived, born in the mind, in the heart. Conceived with conceptions that we have about it, ideas that we have about it. Oftentimes, appearances are conceived in the heart mind as lasting things that can bring lasting happiness or unhappiness to a lasting being. Yeah. Interesting that that happens. But because of the principle in this teaching, the phenomena are appearances in this mind, in this heart, we can change those concepts and we change how they appear. We change the world of appearances. All appearances can be changed. And all the practices that we do reinforce this for us, right? They're all doing this. And you say, I was in this storm of thoughts and I came to a sense of mindfulness. Appearances changed. That's how we knew it. You say, that works, that's good. Appearances changed, including the appearance of how the body feels in this space, how the self feels, and subtle things like how time feels, how space feels, how life feels, how reality feels. But particularly interested in how things feel, that they get lighter, yeah, they pass sooner, they're easier to be with, they fade. And again, this isn't just being clever about, this is what is going on. It all comes back to dukkha. Right? It all comes back to dukkha. And, we don't just start with dukkha because life's terrible, but actually because it's a really useful place to start from. Yeah. It's obvious. And it's obviously not ideal to experience dukkha. And that lack of freedom that we experience at times doesn't have to be that way. We can actually play a part. And of those conditions, the one that the Buddha really pulled out to look at, this tanha, this thirsting, this demanding, this obsessing around things, is something that we can soften. And having a sense of, this appearance doesn't need this obsession, can be released from this obsession. And in fact, we actually also see this kind of build up from this obsession to something really tightening, clenching. And there's this other word. So this word was tanha, meaning thirsting, demanding, obsessing in that way. This other word is upadana, which relates kind of weirdly to sustenance, to fuel, to a burning, yeah, of the experience. But the word is interesting. If you listen to it, upa dana, there's dana in there. The way that Pali is constructed, this may not be proper etymology, the what this word really comes from and means, but like a before a word is like un or in English. It's not dana. Okay, so it's non-dana. And up is related to the word up, and we turned up non-dana. So we've turned up non-dana to the maximum. And when you have non-dana to the maximum, you have this clenched fist in the heart mind. The appearances in the heart mind are clenched, gripped. And what do we do when we realize, oh dear, I've clenched onto something? We open, release back to this still point. Why do we do it though? Because we realize this thing does not contain satisfaction or dissatisfaction from its side. What matters, what these teachings are saying, is it's how we're relating to them that is the dukkha, right? The demanding, the obsessing, circling around, then the clenching onto, the grabbing onto. And we can release that. Right? Does that make sense? Things are not a problem from their own side. So we can make peace with things. We can make peace with ourselves. We're also an appearance in the heart mind. Peace is possible, moment by moment. How should we get there? Well, I think we should change the easiest condition to change for us. The easiest condition, I think, for many of us is softening, opening, relaxing, releasing, bringing in kindness, breathing with kindness, holding with kindness. And we'll notice the other elements will shift, will change. But also what we can do is shift and change the concept underlying things. however we're relating to things, there must be some tension in attention, holding this in attention, gripping it from passing through. And we can remind ourselves, this is not peaceful. This is not peaceful. And there is a peacefulness possible. This is almost like a quote from the Buddha. There is a peacefulness possible for you. This is not peaceful. There is a peaceful way to be. We rest back into that, feel into the back of the being. If we're pushing forwards, or we come into the space, if we're holding back, there is a peaceful way to be with this. And that can be a training, it can be a revelation. Some peace is possible here. And this isn't it. There's more peace than this. More than this. What could open that hasn't yet opened? There's a wonderful awakening poem from a nun who wrote, "The clenched fist in my mind opened and I fell into everything." Unclenching that fist of upadana. So we want a lot of calmness and gathered well-being as we do these practices. So start off with that. We'll emphasize that. And through the day, if you want to drop in at times, that opening, unclenching, tuning into what's more peaceful. Remembering to also include in the day times of dedication to well-being, to kindness, to softness. Because we really want to make sure that when we say, this is not peaceful, it's not an insult. It's an invitation. Yeah. There is something more peaceful. So let's practice this together. So have a little stretch or look after the body, whatever feels helpful. And we'll begin the practice with some settling or grounding, opening. Encouraging a sense of spacious intimacy with experience. Doing that as a contribution, a participation in life. Whatever remains of tension, stress, ill-ease, that can be here. A saying related to wisdom that might be helpful here is that fools seek experiences. The wise seek to understand experience. Whatever experience we're having, we'll get to know it, get to understand it. So much we can learn. We don't need special experiences. feeling how the things we experience, the breath, the sounds, are affected by the softening of the belly, a releasing of the tension we might be holding in the shoulders or the back or the neck. Relaxing the eyes and around the eyes and the jaw. And letting life flow, letting in, letting be, letting go. When anything gets stuck in attention for a little longer than feels necessary, just have that sense of opening the grip, letting our attention be like an open palm that does not demand for things to stay or to go. The breath. Ride with the breath flowing through the body, or the sounds flowing through hearing. Sometimes the mind is going over the past or reaching into the future, making a plan for happiness, fixing, being enough, based around the idea that things arranged the right way bring happiness. What we tend to miss is that in that moment where happiness arises, because what we thought was things arranged the right way, was just the felt experience of ending demands for things to be otherwise. And we can just go straight to ending demands for things to be otherwise. It's a practice, not as a way to live. It's like this, right now. It's already like this. I don't need to fight it. I can make peace. Soften. Open, release. more peaceful way is possible. Getting what we want, or getting rid of what we didn't want, can bring a sense of relief. It's usually quite short, quite temporary. But that relief is also better described as the relief of the conditions of dukkha. Relief of the ending of demands. The opening of contraction, the softening of the self-sense, the expansion of the time pressure. It's not in the things. There is a more peaceful experience possible than this. Opening, releasing, resolving, dissolving. Breathing, listening to whatever remains. Letting in, letting be, letting go. whatever we sense is an appearance, appearance in consciousness. Doesn't have its own substance, it's made of consciousness, made of the heart mind, conceived in the heart mind. And let's not make a problem out of anything as a practice. Maybe not as a way to live, but what happens when we practice? Starting with the body, the touch, consciousness. Feeling the sensations within the sensations of body contact. The vibrations, the energy. Letting it appear without demands, letting it stay, letting it go without demands, with space, not contraction. Letting whatever appears in hearing consciousness, the vibrations beneath the labels of a this or a that, not even worrying about hearing it all, just ensuring it's met with peacefulness, openness, non-demand. The aromas and the smells in the nose. The flavors and the tastes in the mouth. Even more peaceful. What would be more peaceful? As a way of meeting, releasing. And the visual field. Visual consciousness, the optics, the lights, the colors, the shapes. How it is to meet light without demand, darkness without demand. Presence or absence without demand. And the mood and thoughts flowing through the mind, the emotions, these impressions in a mental consciousness, its own kind of consciousness. Wide open, peaceful, non-demand. And there's something more peaceful. Opening into this more peaceful. More peaceful. Thank you for your practice and for allowing me to share an idea around practice. If it feels helpful, feel free to continue with it, explore it. If it doesn't feel so helpful, then feel free to do something that does feel more helpful. That would be the more peaceful thing to do. If you do want to include it, remembering including a lot of the calmness practices, the steadiness practices, they really support this. If it feels really nourishing, then you can do more of it and you'll notice that it might actually support more gathered, more harmonized well-being. If it does, linger in that some of the time, yeah. We can get in a rush of like, wow, maybe there's more peacefulness and I should go get more of that, and more of that. And then it's kind of a little bit losing the point, yeah, like rushing off for more peace. It's kind of, we want this sense things and non-things are not a problem from their own side. Yeah, but there are unskillful, unwise ways of relating to them. And there are more skillful, more wise ways of relating to them. So if there are ways that bring more happiness without having to fix the world and arrange things in that way, then let's do that. Let's change our way of relating and see how much that can do. See what that can do. We can bring this. Okay, kitchen people, you can go. If you, you are released, peaceful, free. So we can also bring this into the movement, how we move the body, how we walk on the earth, how we eat our meals, all of this is open to being done in more peaceful ways. Yeah, we can see the simple act of moving the body with kindness, with softness, with gentleness, with dance, with intimacy, all of this can be an act of peace. Yeah, we can have that sense, this whole Dharma is actually a path of peace. And each time we walk, we're creating a path of peace. Yeah, this path is made by walking. And when we walk it, we create it for ourselves and we create it for others. That can be a beautiful way to practice our movement and looking after the body, looking after ourselves, looking after our community. The community that appears out there and also this community that appears in here, this community of beings that we are. So yeah, I hope that feels helpful. There's nothing here to get right, but there's a lot here we can explore and feel how that feels to bring our wisdom, our equanimity, our peacefulness into this last full day together. So enjoy. Thank you.